Section 6 of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by Howard Phillips Lovecraft. Read by Martin Rato. One starlit evening, when the furrows shone splendid over the harbor, the longed-for ship put in, and strange-faced sailors and traders appeared one by one and group by group in the ancient taverns along the seawall. It was very exciting to see again those living faces so like the godlike features of Ingranik, but Carter did not hasten to speak with the silent seamen. He did not know how much of pride and secrecy and dim supernal memory might fill those children of the great ones, and was sure it would not be wise to tell them of his quest or ask too closely of that cold desert stretching north of their twilight land. They talked little with the other folk in those ancient sea taverns, but would gather in groups in remote corners and sing among themselves the haunting airs of unknown places, or chant long tales to one another in accents alien to the rest of dreamland. And so rare and moving were those airs and tales that one might guess their wonders from the faces of those who listened, even though the words came to common ears only as strange cadence and obscure melody. For a week the strange seamen lingered in the taverns and traded in the bazaars of Seliphice, and before they sailed Carter had taken passage on their dark ship, telling them that he was an old onyx miner and wishful to work in their quarries. That ship was very lovely and cunningly wrought, being of teakwood with ebony fittings and traceries of gold, and the cabin in which the traveler lodged had hangings of silk and velvet. One morning at the turn of the tide, the sails were raised and the anchor lifted, and as Carter stood on the high stern, he saw the sunrise blazing walls and bronze statues and golden minarets of ageless Seliphice sink into the distance, and the snowy peak of Mount Man grow smaller and smaller. By noon there was nothing in sight save the gentle blue of the Serenarian Sea, with one painted galley afar off, bound for that realm of Serenian where the sea meets the sky. And the night came with gorgeous stars, and the dark ship steered for Charles's Wain and the Little Bear as they swung slowly around the pole. And the sailors sang strange songs of unknown places, and they stole off one by one to the forecastle where the wistful watchers murmured old chants and leaned over the rail to glimpse the luminous fish playing in bowers beneath the sea. Carter went to sleep at midnight and rose in the glow of a young morning, marking that the sun seemed farther south than was its wont. And all through that second day he made progress in knowing the men of the ship, getting them little by little to talk of their cold twilight land, of their exquisite onyx city, and of their fear of the high and impassable peaks beyond which Lang was set to be. They told him how sorry they were that no cats would stay in the land of Inquinoc, and how they thought the hidden nearness of Lang was to blame for it. Only of the stony desert to the north they would not talk. There was something disquieting about that desert, and it was thought expedient not to admit its existence. On later days they talked of the quarries in which Carter said he was going to work. There were many of them, for all the city of Inquinoc was builded of onyx, whilst great polished blocks of it were traded in Renar, Ogrothan, and Seliphice, and at home with the merchants of Thra, Flarnac, and Kadatharon, for the beautiful wares of those fabulous ports. And far to the north, almost in the cold desert whose existence the men of Inquinoc did not care to admit, there was an unused quarry greater than all the rest, from which had been hewn in forgotten times such prodigious lumps and blocks that the sight of their chiseled vacancies struck terror to all who beheld. Who had mined those incredible blocks, and whither had they been transported? No man might say, but it was thought best not to trouble that quarry around which such inhuman memories might conceivably cling. So it was left all alone in the twilight, with only the raven and the rumored shantak bird to brood on its immensities. When Carter heard of this quarry, he was moved to deep thought, for he knew from old tales that the Great One's castle atop unknown Kadath is of onyx. Each day the sun wheeled lower and lower in the sky, and the mists overhead grew thicker and thicker, and in 2 weeks there was not any sunlight at all, but only a weird gray twilight shining through a dome of eternal cloud by day, and a cold starless phosphorescence from the underside of that cloud by night. On the 20th day, a great jagged rock in the sea was sighted from afar, the first land glimpsed since man's snowy peak had dwindled behind the ship. Carter asked the captain the name of that rock, but was told that it had no name and had never been sought by any vessel because of the sounds that came from it at night. And when, after dark, a dull and ceaseless howling arose from that jagged granite place, the traveler was glad that no stop had been made, and that the rock had no name. The seamen prayed and chanted till the noise was out of earshot, and Carter dreamed terrible dreams within dreams in the small hours. 2 mornings after that, there loomed far ahead and to the east a line of great gray peaks whose tops were lost in the changeless clouds of that twilight world. And at the sight of them, the sailors sang glad songs, and some knelt down on the deck to pray, so that Carter knew they were come to the land of Inquinoc and would soon be moored to the basalt quays of the great town bearing that land's name. Toward noon, a dark coastline appeared, and before 3 o'clock there stood out against the north the bulbous domes and fantastic spires of the Onyx City. Rare and curious did that archaic city rise above its walls and quays, all of delicate black with scrolls, flutings, and arabesques of inlaid gold. Tall and many-windowed were the houses, and carved on every side with flowers and patterns whose dark symmetries dazzled the eye with a beauty more poignant than light. Some ended in swelling domes that tapered to a point, others in terraced pyramids whereon rose clustered minarets displaying every phase of strangeness and imagination. The walls were low and pierced by frequent gates, each under a great arch rising high above the general level and capped by the head of a god chiseled with that same skill displayed in the monstrous face on distant Negronic. On a hill in the center rose a 16-angled tower greater than all the rest and bearing a high pinnacled belfry resting on a flattened dome. This, the seamen said, was the temple of the Elder Ones, and was ruled by an old high priest, sad with inner secrets. At intervals, the clang of a strange bell shivered over the Onyx City, answered each time by a peal of mystic music made up of horns, viols, and chanting voices. And from a row of tripods on a galley round the high dome of the temple, there burst flares of flame at certain moments, for the priests and people of that city were wise in the primal mysteries and faithful in keeping the rhythms of the Great Ones as set forth in scrolls older than the Pnacotic manuscripts. As the ship rode past the great basalt breakwater into the harbor, the lesser noises of the city grew manifest, and Carter saw the slaves, sailors, and merchants on the docks. The sailors and merchants were of the strange-faced race of the gods, but the slaves were squat, slant-eyed folks, said by rumor to have drifted somehow across or around the impassable peaks from the valleys beyond Leng. The wharves reached wide outside the city wall and bore upon them all manner of merchandise from the galleys anchored there, while at one end were great piles of onyx, both carved and uncarved, awaiting shipment to the far markets of Renar, Orgathan, and Seliphice. It was not yet evening when the dark ship anchored beside a jutting quay of stone, and all the sailors and traders filed ashore and through the arched gate into the city. The streets of that city were paved with onyx, and some of them were wide and straight, whilst others were crooked and narrow. The houses near the water were lower than the rest and bore above their curiously arched doorways certain signs of gold, set to be in honor of the respective small gods that favored each. The captain of the ship took Carter to an old sea tavern where flocked the mariners of quaint countries and promised that he would next day show him the wonders of the Twilight City and lead him to the taverns of the onyx miners by the northern wall. And evening fell, and little bronze lamps were lighted, and the sailors in that tavern sang songs of remote places. But when from its high tower the great bell shivered over the city, and the peal of the horns and viols and voices rose cryptical in answer thereto, all ceased their songs or tales and bowed silent till the last echo died away. For there is a wonder and a strangeness on the twilight city of Inquinoch, and men fear to be lax in its rites, lest a doom and a vengeance lurk unsuspectedly close. Far in the shadows of that tavern, Carter saw a squat form he did not like, for it was unmistakably that of the old slant-eyed merchant he had seen so long before in the taverns of Dilath Lean, who was reputed to trade with the horrible stone villages of Leng which no healthy folk visit, and whose evil fires are seen at night from afar. And even to have dealt with that high priest not to be described, which wears a yellow silken mask over its face and dwells all alone in a prehistoric stone monastery. This man had seemed to show a queer gleam of knowing when Carter asked the traders of Dilath Lean about the cold waste and Kadath, and somehow his presence in dark and haunted Inquinoch, so close to the wonders of the north, was not a reassuring thing. He slipped wholly out of sight before Carter could speak to him, and sailors later said that he'd come with a yak caravan from some point not well determined, bearing the colossal and rich-flavored eggs of the rumored Shantak bird to trade for the dexterous jade goblets that merchants brought from Ilarnec. On the following morning, the ship captain led Carter through the onyx streets of Inquinoch, dark under their twilight sky. The inlaid doors and figured house fronts, carven balconies, and crystal-paned oriels all gleamed with a somber and polished loveliness, and now and then the plaza would open out with black pillars, colonnades, and the statues of curious beings, both human and fabulous. Some of the vistas down long and unbending streets or through side alleys and over bulbous domes, spires, and arabesque roofs were weird and beautiful beyond words, and nothing was more splendid than the massive heights of the great central temple of the Elder Ones with its 16 carven sides, its flattened dome, and its lofty pinnacled belfry overtopping all else, and majestic whatever its foreground. And always to the east, far beyond the city walls and the leagues of pasture land, rose the gaunt gray sides of those topless and impassable peaks across which hideous Leng was set to lie. The captain took Carter to the mighty temple, which is set with its walled garden in a great round plaza, whence the streets go as spokes from a wheel's hub. The seven arched gates of that garden, each having over it a carven face like those on the city's gates, are always open, and the people roam reverently at will down the tiled paths and through the little lanes lined with grotesque termini and the shrines of modest gods. And there are fountains, pools, and basins there to reflect the frequent blaze of the tripods on the high balcony, all onyx and having in them small luminous fish taken by divers from the lower bowers of ocean. When the deep clang from the temple belfry shivers over the gardens and the city, and the answer of the horns and viols and voices peals out from the seven lodges by the garden gates, there issue from the seven doors of the temple long columns of masked and hooded priests in black, bearing at arm's length before them great golden bowls from which a curious steam rises. And all the seven columns strut peculiarly in single file, legs thrown far forward without bending the knees, down the walks that lead to the seven lodges, wherein they disappear and do not appear again. It is said that subterranean paths connect the lodges with the temple, and that the long files of priests return through them. Nor is it unwhispered that deep flights of onyx steps go down to mysteries that are never told. But only a few are those who hint that the priests in the masked and hooded columns are not human beings. Carter did not enter the temple because none but the veiled king is permitted to do that. But before he left the garden, the hour of the bell came, and he heard the shivering clang deafening above him, and the wailing of the horns and viols and voices loud from the lodges by the gates. And down the seven great walks stalked the long files of bowl-bearing priests in their singular way, giving to the traveler a fear which human priests do not often give. When the last of them had vanished, he left that garden, noting as he did so a spot on the pavement over which the bowls had passed. Even the ship captain did not like that spot and hurried him on toward the hill whereon the Veiled King's palace rises many-domed and marvelous. The ways to the Onyx Palace are steep and narrow, all but the broad curving one where the king and his companions ride on yaks or in yak-drawn chariots. Carter and his guide climbed up an alley that was all steps, between inlaid walls bearing strange signs in gold, and under balconies and oriels where sometimes floated soft strains of music or breaths of exotic fragrance. Always ahead loomed those Titan walls, mighty buttresses, and clustered and bulbous domes for which the Veiled King's palace is famous. And at length they passed under a great black arch and emerged in the gardens of the monarch's pleasure. There Carter paused in faintness at so much beauty, for the onyx terraces and colonnaded walks, the gay parterres and delicate flowering trees espaliered to golden lattices, the brazen urns and tripods with cunning bas-reliefs, the pedestaled and almost breathing statues of veined black marble, the basalt-bottomed lagoons, tiled fountains with luminous fish, the tiny temples of iridescent singing birds atop carven columns, the marvelous scrollwork of the great bronze gates and the blossoming vines trained along every inch of the polished walls, all joined to form a sight whose loveliness was beyond reality and half fabulous even in the land of dreams. There it shimmered like a vision under that gray twilight sky, with the domed and fretted magnificence of the palace ahead, and the fantastic silhouette of the distant impassable peaks on the right. And ever the small birds and the fountains sang, while the perfume of rare blossoms spread like a veil over that incredible garden. No other human presence was there, and Carter was glad it was so. Then they turned and descended again the onyx alley of steps, for the palace itself no visitor may enter, and it is not well to look too long and steadily at the great central dome, since it is set to house the archaic father of all the rumored Shantak birds, and to send out queer dreams to the curious. After that, the captain took Carter to the north quarter of the town, near the gate of the caravans, where are the taverns of the yak merchants and the onyx miners. And there, in a low-ceilinged inn of quarrymen, they said farewell, for business called the captain, whilst Carter was eager to talk with miners about the north. There were many men in that inn, and the traveller was not long in speaking to some of them, saying that he was an old miner of onyx and anxious to know somewhat of Inquinox quarries. But all that he learned was not much more than he knew before, for the miners were timid and evasive about the cold desert to the north and the quarry that no man visits. They had fears of fabled emissaries from around the mountains where Leng is set to lie, and of evil presences and nameless sentinels far north among the scattered rocks. And they whispered also that the rumored Shantak birds are no wholesome things, it being indeed for the best that no man has ever truly seen one, for that fabled father of Shantaks in the king's dome is fed in the dark. The next day, saying that he wished to look over all the various mines for himself and to visit the scattered farms and quaint onyx villages of Inquinox, Carter hired a yak and stuffed great leathern saddlebags for a journey. Beyond the gate of the caravans, the road lay straight betwixt tilled fields, with many odd farmhouses crowned by low domes. At some of these houses, the seeker stopped to ask questions, once finding a host so austere and reticent, and so full of an unplaced majesty like to that in the huge features on Granic, that he felt certain he had come at last upon one of the great ones themselves, or upon one with full 9/10 of their blood dwelling amongst men. And to that austere and reticent Carter he was careful to speak very well of the gods, and to praise all the blessings they had ever accorded him. That night Carter camped in a roadside meadow beneath a great ligath tree to which he tied his yak, and in the morning resumed his northward pilgrimage. At about 10 o'clock he reached the small domed village of Urg, where traders rest and miners tell their tales, and paused in its taverns until noon. It is here that the great caravan road turns west towards Salarn, but Carter kept on north by the quarry road. All the afternoon he followed that rising road, which was somewhat narrower than the great highway, and which now led through a region with more rocks than tilled fields. And by evening, the low hills on his left had risen into sizable black cliffs, so that he knew he was close to the mining country. All the while, the great gaunt sides of the impassable mountains towered afar off at his right, and the farther he went, the worse tales he heard of them from the scattered farmers and traders and drivers of lumbering onyx carts along the way. On the second night, he camped in the shadow of a large black crag, tethering his yak to a stake driven in the ground. He observed the greater phosphorescence of the clouds at his northerly point, and more than once thought he saw dark shapes outlined against them. And on the third morning, he came in sight of the first onyx quarry, and greeted the men who there labored with picks and chisels. Before evening he had passed 11 quarries, the land being here given over altogether to onyx cliffs and boulders, with no vegetation at all but only great rocky fragments scattered about a floor of black earth, with the gray, impassable peaks always rising gaunt and sinister on his right. The third night he spent in a camp of quarrymen whose flickering fires cast weird reflections on the polished cliffs to the west, and they sang many songs and told many tales, showing such strange knowledge of the olden days and the habits of gods that Carter could see that they held many latent memories of their sires, the great ones. They asked him whither he went and cautioned him not to go too far to the north. But he replied that he was seeking new cliffs of onyx and would take no more risks than were common among prospectors. In the morning he bade them adieu and rode on into the darkening north, where they had warned him he would find the feared and unvisited quarry whence hands older than men's hands had wrenched prodigious blocks. But he did not like it when, turning back to wave a last farewell, he thought he saw approaching the camp that squat and evasive old merchant with slanting eyes, whose conjectured traffic with Lang was the gossip of distant Dilathleen. After two more quarries, the inhabited part of Inquinox seemed to end, and the road narrowed to a steeply rising yak path among forbidding black cliffs. Always on the right towered the gaunt and distant peaks, and as Carter climbed farther and farther into this untraversed realm, he found it grew darker and colder. Soon he perceived that there were no prints of feet or hooves on the black path beneath, and realized that he was indeed come into strange and deserted ways of elder time. Once in a while a raven would croak far overhead, and now and then a flapping behind some vast rock would make him think uncomfortably of the rumored Shantak bird. But in the main he was alone with his shaggy steed, and it troubled him to observe that this excellent yak became more and more reluctant to advance, and more disposed to snort affrightedly at any small noise along the route. The path now contracted between sable and glistening walls and began to display an even greater steepness than before. It was a bad footing, and the yak often slipped on the stony fragments strewn thickly about. In 2 hours, Carter saw ahead a definite crest beyond which was nothing but dull gray sky, and blessed the prospect of a level or downward course. To reach this crest, however, was no easy task, for the way had grown nearly perpendicular and was perilous with loose black gravel and small stones. Eventually, Carter dismounted and let his dubious yak, pulling very hard when the animal balked or stumbled, and keeping his own footing as best he might. Then suddenly he came to the top and saw beyond, and gasped at what he saw. The path, indeed, led straight ahead and slightly down, with the same lines of high natural walls as before, but on the left hand there opened out a monstrous space, vast acres in extent, where some archaic power had riven and rent the native cliffs of onyx in the form of a giant's quarry. Far back into the solid precipice ran that cyclopean gouge, and deep down within earth's bowels its lower delvings yawned. It was no quarry of man, and the concave sides were scarred with great squares, yards wide, which told of the size of the blocks once hewn by nameless hands and chisels. High over its jagged rim, huge ravens flapped and croaked, and vague whirrings in the unseen depths told of bats or urhags, or less mentionable presences haunting the endless blackness. There Carter stood in the narrow way amidst the twilight with the rocky path sloping down before him. Tall onyx cliffs on his right that led on as far as he could see, and tall cliffs on the left chopped off just ahead to make that terrible and unearthly quarry. All at once the yak uttered a cry and burst from his control, leaping past him and darting on in a panic till it vanished down the narrow slope toward the north. Stones kicked by its flying hoofs fell over the brink of the quarry and lost themselves in the dark without any sound of striking bottom. But Carter ignored the perils of that scanty path as he raced breathlessly after the flying steed. Soon the left-behind cliffs resumed their course, making the way once more a narrow lane. And still the traveler leaped on after the yak whose great wide prints told of its desperate flight. Once he thought he heard the hoofbeats of the frightened beast and doubled his speed from this encouragement. He was covering miles, and little by little the way was broadening in front till he knew he must soon emerge on the cold and dreaded desert to the north. The gaunt gray flanks of the distant impassable peaks were again visible above the right-hand crags, and ahead were the rocks and boulders of an open space which was clearly a foretaste of the dark, arid, limitless plain. And once more those hoofbeats sounded in his ears, plainer than before, but this time giving terror instead of encouragement, because he realized that they were not the frightened hoofbeats of his fleeing yak. The beats were ruthless and purposeful, and they were behind him.